there, and welcome to Hidden Behind the Music Stand. I'm your host, Patty Ryan, and with me is Siggy Yap, who is a violist based in Houston, Texas, and performs with ensembles Kinetic, Loop 38, and Musica. He is also passionate about arts education and community impact, and is a founding executive officer of the Houston Viola Society. He also dips his toes in arts administration, and is the marketing and social media specialist for Chamber Music Houston, and we'll be talking about his fascination in collecting contemporary stringed instruments and bows. Welcome, Siggy. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, Patty. Yeah, thanks so much for having me and including me in this wonderful podcast.
Aw, thanks. Yeah. So it's funny to me how we first met, because of course we first met with one of my greatest friends, Michelle Black. I met you basically because you were roommates. And then there was one time when I first was a student at Rice and I needed to use the copy room, and I was just busy doing my own thing, and you said hi to me, and I just like completely blanked on like who you were, and you were so kind of like offer like, oh, my name's Siggy, I'm Michelle's roommate. I was like, oh my god, yes, of course. And since then, like, I just like, how could I ever not remember who you are? You're just such an important person in not just my life, but the musical fabric of Houston.
Oh, yeah, I was roommates with Michelle Black for 5 years, I think. Mm-hmm. And I know you guys go way back to undergrad, so I mean, I had heard about you, and I think there was one time you came to Houston for an audition, but
that's,
I think,
right,
you were like in and out super fast. And
well, and I also had the flu as well, one of those times, so okay. I'm really glad none of you guys got sick from me, but
yeah, I mean, like, I think we had only met briefly, and so when you finally moved to Houston, yeah, you know, got so embedded, and yeah, it was great to work with you on so many wonderful projects and get to know you as a dear friend.
Yeah. What is your most insane performance story?
Okay, so I have to set this up. Here's the backstory. My senior year of undergrad, I was one of the co-presidents for Student Government Association. And the end of the year spring picnic happens on the lawn. It's, you know, end of April, beginning of May. And co-presidents and I, with the encouragement of student body, decided to rent some sumo wrestling suits.
Uh-oh.
For the spring picnic.
Okay.
And my friend Carlos and I, fellow Filipino string player, decided, yeah, let's go head-to-head in this sumo wrestling match. And the last thing I remember was charging at each other at full speed and then waking up somewhere in the grass moments later. But apparently, like, we just, you know, we collided and I bounced off of him and I flew, like, past the wrestling mat. Fast forward, I ended up getting a concussion and whiplash.
Oh, my God.
And then... And then a couple days later, had this, you know, I still remember it as one of the highlights of my musical education and performance experiences. I mean, dear friends, we had been working together for a little over a year, but we were performing Mozart's Dissonance Quartet.
Uh-huh.
For the intensive string quartet seminar. And I mean, the sense of flow in that moment of performing that quartet with dear friends, musical partners, on top of being concussed days before and having whiplash, I mean, it... I will always remember that as, like, insane. Yeah, when you said that, like, insane, I was like, that is one of the experiences in my life that I'll always remember. In addition to, like, great music making, but, like, not being in the best physical state, but still, like, powering through it and, like, loving it.
Yeah, okay, so the performance was fine, but just the fact that you, I mean, how could you even hold your viola with whiplash?
It was tough. I was on a lot of painkillers, and, you know, luckily the concussion didn't progress worse than it had been. But, yeah, I mean, the performance itself, I guess, in its entirety went really well. And I still occasionally, like, listen back to that recording. So I know it was quite good. But the whole setup, I actually don't know that I've had any, like, huge mishaps in that regard. I was kind of like going through my Rolodex of performances and trying to think if there's anything like really outlandish, but
yeah. No, I mean, I guess note to self, days before performance, don't charge at someone else with a sumo wrestling costume on.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I mean, it just feels like such a cartoonish image to mm-hmm. see, like, I mean, mm-hmm. did Carlos also just rebound similarly, or was he fine? He was fine.
He was fine. Okay. Totally fine.
Maybe yours was extra inflated for some reason. I don't know.
Yeah, but I remember going to the hospital and they were like, what kind of fraternity hazing thing was this? And no, this was like, I'm one of the co-presidents for the Student Government Association. It was a spring picnic, you know.
Yeah.
And they were just like,
Judgy, judgy.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for sharing that story.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about Kimchi? Not to be mistaken with the drag queen performer, you know. But can you tell me about Kimchi and Puppy?
So I have two cats. Patrick, my partner, and I, we have two cats. I've had Kimchi since 2013. So the reason why she's called Kimchi, actually, a couple of my friends named her. So I can't take the credit, but we had dinner in Chinatown in Houston, and we went to a great Korean restaurant. It was pouring rain after, and we were going up the stairs to a Japanese gift shop, and this cat runs past me sobbing wet, and she's just like shivering, aww, soaking wet, and she lets me pick her up. And so we go inside the Japanese gift store and say, like, there's a cat, like, do you have a box? So one of my friends gets the box, and this is unusual for her now, but at the time she let us pick her up and like hold her, put her in the box. So I brought her home, and I thought, like, okay, like I'll try and either find her a home or get her to one of the adoption centers, and
sure,
decided to keep her as, yeah, much as, you know, my roommate Michelle is probably like apprehensive. Not a cat person. I think she's, yeah, she's an animal person, but I think maybe not.
Well, I mean, Kenji is her love, who's her Australian shepherd.
Right, yeah, right. But so Kimchi and I have been together since 2013. Puppy, the cat named Puppy, right? We adopted him in 2019. So almost 2 years ago, November 2019. Our friends found him in San Antonio. It was a Saturday. And I think a lot of the shelters and adoption centers don't do intake on weekends.
Oh, great.
So to his benefit, he's a chirpy one. He's very needy and he wants attention all the time. So I think he was like under a car, like yelping and like, aww, howling and meowing. And so got our friends' attention, and they picked him up and brought him back to Houston, and they have a cat. So they're like, well, we can't really keep him here. Like, they're not getting along. Also, like, their landlord wasn't going to be okay with another cat. So fast forward, we were just thinking about fostering Puppy and decided to keep him.
Oh, so yeah. It seems like any cat that enters your life, I mean, it ends up, you just envelop them in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And his name, Patrick actually named him, probably despite me.
I see. Okay. Well, I mean, it definitely is memorable to code switch like that.
Right, right.
Okay, well, I know you're an amazing cat dad, so please give them head scratches for me.
Oh, will do.
Are you ready for some spitfire questions?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, Mahler or Bruckner?
Ooh, Mahler.
Debussy or Ravel?
Ravel.
Your face.
I mean, viola solos, like, love them all in both pieces.
Just for clarity, you said Ravel, right?
Ravel, yeah.
Yeah. Cats or dogs?
Cats.
Oh my God, what if you said dogs?
Throw your curveball.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Kenji's the only dog I've ever lived with. But I've always, growing up, I had always wanted a dog or other animals. I think I'm an all-around animal person.
Yeah.
But it's just cats are so much easier.
Cats are. And they also, I don't know, they're just so cozy. And
yeah, they're easier until you get the one named Puppy. And it's like it's like having a toddler.
Well, right. And he's still a kitten too, right? So
yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of spunky energy going on. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Appetizer or dessert?
Dessert. Sometimes dessert is my appetizer.
Okay, I can take that. I'll take that answer. Sparkling or still water?
Sparkling.
Fan favorite question. Alternate universe musical instrument?
I think clarinet.
Okay.
And that's partly because I'm envious of, like, I mean, there are multiple clarinets, and if you play all of them, then you end up with like a lot of instruments lugging around. But like, I do envy sometimes when it's just a nice little backpack. Also, I mean, I do love the instrument as well.
What's wrong with the viola?
No, I mean, nothing.
I mean, it's
nothing.
Not that big.
I mean, they're sort of akin in terms of like register and how, yeah, they fit into the family of each section.
Sure. Fair enough. Early bird or night owl?
Night owl.
Pandemic guilty pleasure?
Ooh. We bought a Nintendo Switch last year.
Are we friends? Can we be friends on Switch?
Yeah, we can. I don't know if we have a subscription. Do we have to like have the subscription to be friends?
You mean the online subscription?
Yeah.
Oh, no, we can still be friends, but we can't play games together unless you get the online subscription.
Okay, so you have the subscription.
Yeah.
So it's worth it.
I'm part of a family plan. Yeah. It is worth it because then you can play with friends like Mario Kart and stuff. Yeah.
Oh, all the things you're teaching me.
So what games do you play on Switch?
Mario Party, Mario Kart, Super Smash Brothers. Mm-hmm.
Well, let me know when you get an online subscription, because then we can play games together.
Yeah, that'd be fun. We'll do.
Favorite professor shout out?
Ooh. So many like really important people in my life. Can I do a power couple?
Sure.
Jeff Irvine and Lynn Ramsey. Yeah, shout out to them. My undergrad teachers in Cleveland. I first met Jeff Irvine when I was, I think, going into my junior year of high school at Encore School for Strings. At the time, that was CIM's summer program. I mean, just on top of being an amazing and incredible person, so giving and kind, really was instrumental in changing my technique, how I practice, how I think about problem solving. When I think about like teachers that helped me become a teacher, he comes to mind. And then same thing with his wife, Lynn Ramsey. Oh, just truly a power couple. But in 2010, 11, and 12, before I moved to Houston, I was out of school after my father passed away. And she so graciously like was teaching me out of school and just so supportive. And, you know, there were some times where I left lessons where she'd hand me like food and treats and dessert. And I was just like, Ms. Ramsey, like, I'm getting more out of this than you are.
That's not true. I mean, you know, you must know that, right? It's her pleasure to be able to help you along your path of music.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I have some students here that, you know, are always very thankful of my time and generosity. And I always say that it's because of Jeff Irvine and Lynn Ramsey and how much they paid it forward.
Yeah.
And I always remember one of the things she said to me is someday when you're a teacher, you're going to be able to do the same. And so I always do that as homage to them.
Oh, that's such a sweet tribute to them. Thanks for sharing that.
Oh, you're welcome.
Most inspired musical hero of any genre?
Oscar Peterson comes to mind. Pianist Oscar Peterson. I love his recordings. One of my best friends in high school was a jazz drummer, and he introduced me to Oscar Peterson. So when I need a break from classical music, I often just will unwind and listen to Oscar Peterson Trio.
Yeah, it's great. Most transformative performance experience?
So many. Where do I even begin? I think this goes back with that quartet that I was with at the end of my time at CIM. We were playing Beethoven 135 as part of the IQS seminar. That performance.
Intensive string quartet seminar, right?
Correct. Yeah. I know it's called something else now, but...
Well, what about it?
I mean, those particular colleagues, I can give a shout out to them, Ling Ling Huang, Miran Kim, and Erica Snowden Rodriguez. Incredible people, but such sensitive musicians. I mean, the whole process of learning a late Beethoven quartet with good friends, I think, is the pinnacle of music making. But I remember in that moment, just the coming together on that stage and the months of hard work, the many hours of practicing, recording, masterclasses, and then feeling that sense of flow with close friends. It's just so rewarding.
Yeah. It's almost like you're able to speak a totally different language between each other, but it's so unverbal. It's just like this extra layer of intimate connection that I think that's, if I can try to put it into words, is what you probably were experiencing. And then that way is transformative because on a day-to-day basis, we don't always function at that level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that brings a good point. Something that the Cavani String Quartet and Peter Salaf would say before we would perform is run through your checklist of goals. And, you know, they can be like technical things like measure whatever, you know, we're going for this kind of sound or intonation or whatever. But I always remember like the emotional side and feeling like we could just lay it all out and wear our hearts on our sleeves. What you said is a good reminder that that was one of our goals, is just to wear our hearts on our sleeves.
Right. But not just wear your hearts on your sleeves, but trust that everyone is doing so. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. I think that's the second layer to that higher level of chamber music performance. Being okay and comfortable being vulnerable with each other.
That's beautiful.
Oh, thank you. I don't know. Okay, desert island piece of any genre?
Going back to Oscar Peterson's Trio, Walking the Line, that's a go-to album.
Why?
Probably because it was one of the first jazz albums that my friend gave me, but I don't know, I just connected with it, just loved the groove. Always puts me in a good mood, no matter what I'm feeling. It's kind of a go-to. It takes me to another place.
Okay, so you're looking for escapism on your desert island.
Yes.
Okay, got you. All right, well, Siggy, you've made it through the Spitfire questions. Congratulations.
Woo. Bravo.
I really need to upgrade my slide whistle.
True virtuoso there.
This thing was like $7. It's a piece of garbage. Okay, Siggy, it's time. Can you walk me through your musical origin story? How did you discover music? How did you discover the viola? When did you decide that that was going to be your path in life? And all the steps through your education to where you are today?
Sure. So I started playing viola either third or fourth grade, but my eldest brother used to play viola. And one of the stories that I remember, he'd bring his viola home and I just started opening the case and picking it up and playing, not knowing what I was doing. And I remember one of those days where I was surreptitious practically playing his viola. I broke a string.
Oh.
And I didn't get in trouble, but I think my parents saw that I was very curious about it. And then when it came time for our school program in elementary school, picking instruments, I ended up choosing a viola.
So you're an OG authentic violist.
I am, yeah. Didn't start on violin. Sometimes I wish I did, but...
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
I mean, it has its merits, for sure. I mean, you know, like... Sometimes I wish I had started earlier. I mean, you know, a lot of violinists start younger. Maybe it's just like an insecurity thing, but like I often feel like through my education, I often felt like I was playing catch up.
Well, oh my gosh, that's such a common theme for like, I feel like everyone feels that way, even if they started young.
Yeah, so it was about maybe 2-3 years after that, I started to surpass my brother and
was that weird?
No, I don't think so. There was never any, I jokingly say like I'm the outsider of the Yat family. Oh. I mean, because we being the youngest of three boys, we're all 2 years apart, and so I didn't overlap. By the time I was like, you know, in late elementary school, my brothers were already 7th grade, 9th grade, so they actually went to the same high school and undergrad, and they were in the same fraternity and then lived together. But it was kind of my way of finding my own path, because they were always like the really smart ones and athletic ones, and music was the way that I stood out in another direction. And they were always so supportive, like there was never any tension. And like when it came to like playing in ensembles or like doing solo competitions and things like that, region, all-state auditions, like it was never any tension. But I think one of my first experiences getting into all-state when I was in middle school, I know we played, it might have been like a Howard Hanson symphony. Mm-hmm. I remember coming back and some of my friends like asking how it went. And I think in those moments of playing in the all-state orchestra, I realized I no longer wanted to be a doctor and I wanted to be a professional musician.
Yeah, just because of how the music made you feel kind of thing. And
how it made me feel, like the camaraderie, the connection. I found like a sense of community, mm-hmm. people that we understood each other. It was just so much fun. I was excelling in it, and you know, it was something other than like academics. So you can get the thread of this, you know, escapism.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so going into high school, you mm-hmm. had this sense, hey, I'm going to go the music route.
Mm-hmm. I remember a close friend from high school. She was, I think, maybe a year or two older than me. She was in the high school all-state orchestra, and I remember her coming up to me and saying, the viola teacher at our high school, Richard Fleischman, has heard about you and is interested in if you want to come to New World School of the Arts. So I was like, wow, this big deal, and you know, teacher in Miami, Florida, and had heard about him, has heard about me. So that kind of got me thinking about New World School of the Arts, going to performing arts high school. My parents were not fans of me doing that. I mean, it's a high school downtown, but also visual and performing arts. And so they were kind of just like, you know, always wanting me to go the academic route.
Sure. That's where the money is, right? That's what they think.
Yeah. And, you know, it's uncharted territory. Like Filipinos in general, you know, like when you know, they're thinking of success in terms of career, it's the stock careers, doctor, mm-hmm. lawyer, accountant, yada, yada.
Well, I would say just most immigrant families and then mm-hmm. first generation, which we are, that's, right. You know, it's like, we didn't move here to have you not be successful, in their mind, successful, right? That kind of idea.
Yeah. So fast forward, went to New World School of the Arts and studied with Richard Fleischman. And that continued opening up so many opportunities. Actually, some of my best friends from that elementary school program and through middle school, we all ended up going to the same high school program. So that was a big part of it too, is that sense of community kept moving together.
Right. They were like a little cohort in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, of course, meeting new friends, and it was just like everyone coming from all over Miami-Dade County to attend the school. And then just the encouragement from my teacher then to really pursue viola, going to summer festivals with his encouragement. And yeah, I mean, I remember like learning so much, and I was probably such a little like viola nerd at the time, just like listening to all these recordings. And I remember like studio classes where we would just listen to different recordings and like talk about them.
Wow.
So, and learning the repertoire. And so that just piqued my curiosity, and I would just like try and find things in the library and check them out. And even if I couldn't play them, you know, I remember coming in to one of our studio classes with the Shostakovich viola sonata. And I mean, at the time, I remember him being like telling me a story of him playing it for Maxim Shostakovich. And basically the gist of the story at the end was, you know, like, it's a very mature piece, and put it away and come back to it.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, there's so many pieces that are similar, right? I mean, but I think that is part of the joy of music, is that we're always maturing with the music as we age ourselves and as that music sits with us too, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a bit of that marination. Anyway, but continue on.
Yeah. And then so that kind of lines up with when I ended up going to Encore whenever that was, summer of 2003 or 2004. Yeah. And I think that was 2004 when I met Jeff Irvine. You know, did the audition circuit, but Mr. Irvine, I knew that I was going to get so much from studying with him and continuing becoming a stronger musician overall and honing my technique with him. And then because I spent a couple summers in Cleveland for Encore, it felt like my next home.
So you did your undergraduate at Cleveland Institute of Music?
I think when I arrived, I mean, the level was so high. I know that like shortly thereafter, there was a bit of turnover, but all the studios were just phenomenal. Yeah, I think especially the first 2 to 3 years, David Sorin was still president at that time. It might have been Richard Aaron's last year. But yeah, I mean, this truly, truly inspiring time there. Oh, and also feeling like I needed to catch up.
And then you went to Rice. How did you decide to go there?
I started my master's degree at NEC, actually. Unfortunately, my father passed away the first week of school when I was supposed to start at NEC. So I took some time off, came back in the spring semester. And as much as I wanted to stay in Boston, I mean, I still love Boston as a city. The musical community there, it wasn't the right fit for me at the time. And I was yearning for my friends, a support system. My boyfriend at the time was still there. And so it felt like the natural thing for me to move back. As much as it was move back to Cleveland. So I left Boston in the spring of 2011. And then I don't think this is controversial to say, but like I remember when I moved back to Cleveland, I mean, I was like surreptitiously living in the dorm. And I think Nathan Watts was an RA at the time. So it's funny to look back and like anytime I would see the RAs, I would just like hide.
Run away.
Yeah, because I was this like squatter living in the undergrad dorm. But yeah, shortly after moving back to Cleveland, my quartet mates, we started playing together again. And then that summer, I got asked to join a quartet with Bosun Mo and a couple others. They had a personnel change. And so it was just like all these things were lining up. I had my friends, support system, and then even more chamber music outlets. So decided to stay in Cleveland. And as I mentioned earlier, studying with Lynn Ramsey out of school, and then eventually moved to Houston the same year that Paul Cantor was moving down to Houston.
Right.
So again, a lot of friends moved down coincidentally. I remember when we were all deciding to come down to Houston or even to take the audition, a lot of Paul Cantor's studio hadn't visited Houston, you know, because he knew he was taken down to come here. And so some people were like, is there tumbleweed? Do people really wear like cowboy boots and cowboy hats? And you know, it was the Wild West, you know, for us Northerners, Midwesterners. Yeah. So yeah, and then I've lived in Houston ever since. So it's now the city that I've lived in the longest since Miami.
Yeah. So, I mean, you completed your master's.
My master's degree, yep.
At Rice. And then after that was essentially freelancing. How did you get connected with all these groups, either in a performance side or in an administrative side?
Yeah, I'll start with the administrative side. So when I first came to Rice, for those that know the mailroom at the Shepherd School, it's also the office for Chamber Music Houston. Sometimes when we're working in there, we get asked questions about the copy machine and staplers and tape and paper clips, but we're not the mail room attendants. But I saw this poster, actually, the one behind me right there. That's my first season working for Chamber Music Houston. And that lineup, Tokyo String Quartet, Pavel Haas, Talis Scholars, Griffin Trio, Artemis, Aben, Emerson. I mean, still one of my favorite seasons ever. And I asked my now boss, Karen, I said, you know, I'm a new graduate student. I have a chamber music background and I'm interested in learning more about nonprofits. Do you guys have any like opportunities or do you like do any internships or anything like that? And she was excited that I just cold called, like walked into the room and asked her. Mm-hmm. And so she offered me, you know, she asked me to send her some like samples of work and my resume. And then it went from there. And so.
So sometimes you can just walk in and say, hey, I'm interested. How can I help? And people will say, yes, here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Wow.
So worked my way up into various roles. During my time as a graduate student at Rice, I was graduate student advisor to the board. So I got to attend a lot of the board meetings, offer some insight and my opinions on artistic planning, selecting programs and artists. Especially like when ensembles would have personnel changes and they would be curious about like, oh, well, you know, this ensemble has a new second violinist and, you know, no one had maybe heard of who was joining that ensemble. I had overlapped with them at school, for example, or, you know, met them at a festival or played with them at some festival. And so got to be like, oh, absolutely. I love them. And like, I know they're going to be a great addition. So just having that inside perspective to give the board of directors some my thoughts. And then increasingly started getting on to working in more marketing, social media. Yeah. So I wear a number of hats for that organization. And it's really helped me learn the nonprofit side.
The business aspect.
The business side, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then for a lot of the contemporary chamber music that I do in Houston, so Kinetic Ensemble.
Yay!
Yeah, our founder and artistic director, Natalie Lin, she and I first met in Cleveland. You know, she also went to CIM. I didn't get to plan the project conductorless.
Baby Connecticut.
Yeah. But then I think our official first season was 2015. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I was part of that. And it's just been a highlight and joy being in that ensemble and some of the best, you know, musical experiences. I purposely didn't, you know, mention some of those because I know I listened to your podcast. And so I know some of your other guests have mentioned those really wonderful experiences from Sky Space and all the rep that we've done there. And,
right. Yeah, some really awesome performance opportunities we've had and just some magical ones too. Mm-hmm, you know, similar to what I was talking about where I feel like we are all fused in one moment together and just all trusting like the vulnerability. And with such a large ensemble, it magnifies that level of chamber musician and bonding between the personnel in the ensemble.
Yeah, absolutely. Another ensemble, Loop 38. I joined, I think it was in the third season, and being the only violist in the ensemble, and, you know, admittedly, I didn't play a lot of contemporary music before Kinetic or Loop 38, but it's been quite liberating because, I mean, for some of these brand new pieces that haven't been recorded or ever performed in Houston, you get to make it your own even more than with other of the, you know, common practice era pieces. And some of them are just really darn hard, technically challenging, but like I think heightened my musicianship.
Yeah.
You kind of problem solve in the same ways and you have to overcome the technical challenges. And when it comes down to it, just convey your emotions, convey the characters and check that baggage of or insecurities and just really perform something no matter how technically challenging it is or how obscure it might sound to the audience. I mean, some of the stuff that we do from floor squeaks, you know, with our sneakers to, I mean, there, I think my first season with Loop 38, I was playing viola as percussion more than the viola sometimes. Yeah, that was a fun experience where I have a carbon fiber bow. And so having to use that as a percussion instrument on various things. Also, I remember that first season, I think we did a collaboration with Ecosono playing with water and ice. Ecosono, Matthew Bertner is the director. But yeah, like having to like swish water for certain effects and crunching ice to be the sound of snow melting. Lots of different things I've never expected myself to be doing as a violist. And then, yeah, Musica is another contemporary organization that I do a lot of projects with. Phenomenal group of composers that run that organization. Kind of similar to Loop 38, but just lots of new repertoire.
Yeah. So, I mean, clearly you wear a lot of hats, right? And a lot of them are within the performing realm, but also within the administrative business realm. And I look at your career and I see it as a success in the music field, even though like it might not seem like that on paper to some people. And this is all in air quotes right now, giant sarcastic air quotes, but that's the new version of what our career, what it really looks like is being the jack of all trades, diversifying your expertise and being a use or help in various ways, not just with your instrument. I mean, every time I come and play with you in Kinetic, I'm always excited to play with you. You're such a great colleague. You're such a great member, musician, and I look forward to the next time that we are able to do so.
Yeah, I can't wait for you to come back and to play again with the band.
Yeah. Well, are you ready to take a break, Siggy?
Sure.
Okay, we'll be right back. Welcome back from the break. So Siggy, how did you start getting interested in collecting contemporary stringed instruments and bows?
Yeah, let's back up to 2008 or
wow.
so. One of my best friends during undergrad, and actually we've gone to all the same schools, Aaron Connitz, we went on this road trip to New York City and might have been a couple other cities along the way. And we were both looking for violas at the time. Mm-hmm. He's just a year older than me. And just full steam ahead on this trip, I think we had like six or seven like appointments at shops. And on that trip, we must have tried over 80 violas collectively. Yeah. And the one that won my heart over was an instrument made in 2006 by a modern German maker. Actually, there were two by a modern German maker and his business partner. So the one that I ended up choosing, he's actually a physicist who turned violin maker. And so throughout that process in 2008, I really got to learn a lot about modern instrument makers. And from there, started to help a lot of my friends during undergrad find instruments and could recommend. And, oh, like the shop has this and check out this maker. That's actually kind of like the instrument side.
Can we back up just a hair? Just for people who might not know how intimate the relationship is between musician to instrument, especially with strings. I mean, we're going to only speak strings. I'll hopefully have woodwind, brass, and percussion players on in the future to discuss their relationships to their instrument, but we're talking strings just today. So why is it so specific? And how does one usually go about finding an instrument for themselves?
Mm. And I would say that it's even more so personal when it comes to viola. I mean, it's the only instrument that doesn't truly have a standard size.
Meaning the violin has particular dimensions of height or length or width. I mean, maybe the width is a little bit more subjective. Like there's a Stradivarius model, there's a Guarneri model. With cellos, similarly, there's a kind of set model. There's a Stradivarius A, there's a piccolo Stradivarius, there's a Montagnana. With basses, there's also a little bit more variation, similar to a viola, but violas, it's like luthiers have tried everything to try to make a viola sound good. Not intending for the viola joke here, but...
Yeah. So you covered a lot of that. As you mentioned, the different makers and what we call patterns. When it comes to the viola, like for it to really be where it lies in the instrument family, the string instrument family, it needs to be something like 17 and a half to 18 and a half inches, if not longer.
But so longer really... is almost unplayable.
Exactly.
Yeah. Unless you play like a mini cello, which no one does.
Right. So there's that conundrum of how do you get the alto voice in the string family without it being too large to play. And so you can, you know, makers have tried, as you mentioned, all sorts of things, changing different sizes of the bouts. I mean, so in terms of like string length, that for me is something that I'm a big advocate for, especially like when my students are looking or helping friends and colleagues find new violas, is something that we don't realize is that the string length, the vibrating string length from the bridge to the nut just past where we put our fingers can change from instrument to instrument. So it's really hard to, you know, you can hand a violin or switch violins within a section, for example, and with some variation, it'll be like generally the same. But with viola, you might have someone playing on a 15 and a half inch instrument and someone playing on a 17 inch instrument right next to you. And that sort of is the case. One of my colleagues this week is playing on an instrument much larger than mine. I'm just like, wow, like, you know, he's 6 foot tall something and I'm, you know, much smaller. So there's a lot of variation. And as I mentioned, like that can make or break one's decision. So that is always like the dimensions are always the first thing that I look for and tell my colleagues and friends to look for when shopping for a new instrument. And so there's that, you know, just the physically, it's a very personal thing. But then when finding an instrument, it's our musical voice. And so finding something that expresses what we are trying to say through our playing, through our music making. And I think we all have or strive for an ideal sound. And so that's always interesting, hearing what people are looking for in an instrument. I know that my priorities are, you know, projection, clarity, having something between a tenor and baritone voice. So that's just quite fascinating to try instruments back to back to back, that they're all different sizes and hearing what they do differently.
Right. So this is going to be a leading question. Why isn't there one systemized instrument out there that everyone could play? And if they just made a carbon copy of this instrument, there wouldn't be any variation and there wouldn't be a need to search or to have things.
Yeah, that kind of goes in line with what you're saying, like how you can take the same instrument and everyone that plays it will sound, have a general baseline sound on it, but someone, the way their technique and how they play is going to create different sounds, respond differently to the instrument and vice versa. So, I mean, these aren't just like stock things that we take off a rack and, you know, it's not like a shoe, you put it on, it either fits or doesn't. There's a lot more nuance and potential.
And often I like to think of it like the Harry Potter wand selection, where you can pick up any wand in Ollivander's and it might work, but the one that really, like, you pick it up and sparks just fly out instantly or whatever, that's the one. It's like there's this feeling connection, this kinesthetic connection between the box of wood and us as musicians. And it's something that's slightly indescribable.
Yeah, there's that je ne sais quoi.
Yeah. So now that we've kind of covered some basics in terms of the reasons for and why there's so many varieties, why modern instruments?
Well, going back to my viola specifically, I mean, I was looking at things also older, but when it comes down to the financial cost and that practicality, oftentimes they're significantly cheaper.
But modern.
Yeah. You know, so you might have, for example, I currently had been trying a viola from 1788. It's a much smaller instrument, beautiful sound, but it's priced at something from 1788.
What, triple digits?
Potentially. Whereas my modern viola, when I got it in 2008, it was barely breaking 20,000. So there's the financial cost as well.
Right. But there's also a couple other cons to old instruments, which is that because they've lived so long, there's more likely for there to be damage with the instrument.
Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, you know, friends that are fortunate to play on, you know, fantastic antique instruments, some of them say, oh, they're really difficult to play, or the maintenance, they're finicky, susceptible to humidity. Oftentimes sometimes open seams. You know, as much as they love the sound and what they're able to do with those instruments, sometimes it's maybe even more work than a modern instrument, mm-hmm. more upkeep. So I think I'd say those are some of the cons in addition to the cost.
I mean, obviously the pro for these, as you say, antique instruments or the ones that are older is that there is a trajectory of maturity of color and sound from those instruments. Someone else has been resonating this box, this wood, for years and years and years, which changes the, I mean, I don't know if the chemistry is the right word, but it changes the overall sound and the way that the wood interacts with one another on a physical level. So that's right. Why these instruments are priced so much, because time is an element that we can't immediately use right now. Like, you know, so the, I mean, I'm just trying to say there are pros to it. However, there is a lot of cons. So back to modern instruments, though, other than just being at a lower price point, sometimes a little bit more reliable in terms of weather and potentially easier to play. How do you even get going in searching for this?
Yeah, going back to that point quickly, I mean, as the first owner, sometimes we're the ones that are unlocking this chest of potential and creating the initial palette or possibilities of what the instrument can do. So that's an exciting thing as well when you have a new instrument. But going back to your question, there are about 4 people that have been really inspirational and motivating in my path, specifically with modern bows. So in 2014, there was an antique bow that I fell in love with and really wanted and was working toward acquiring it. And unfortunately, it didn't work out. And so that set me back a little bit. I'll give a shout out to those people. So my Rice professor, Ivo van der Werf, who very much is into bows, instruments as well, but he got me on that path with thinking about the possibilities of what a new bow could do. And so when I found that antique bow on a trip to New York, I mean, I fell in love with it. Didn't work out. And then 3 people that I just absolutely admire and cherish their expertise and like think that they have some of the best bow collections that I've come across. Sawyer Thompson is a great friend now, and definitely think he's on the path to becoming one of the leading experts in the bow world. And he just made one of his very first bows. I mean, I haven't seen it yet, but I've only seen pictures and it's phenomenal. So someone to check out, Sawyer Thompson. And then Sean Bishop in London. Anytime I go to London, I always visit his shop and check out what he has, especially his viola bows. I mean, oof. I mean, it's just like a kid in a candy store trying these bows, whether they're modern bows or antique bows. And then another friend in Seoul, Korea, Jiwon Yi, is a big bow collector. And so getting to know these people has really kind of shaped and led me down the path of modern bows. But back to my story of that antique bow not working out. So I went back to the drawing board and I had to say, okay, my budget is very different now. How do I find something that sounds as good as that antique bow or better? And ended up finding a bow shortly thereafter that I just loved and was a good fit with my instrument. And, you know, I always say that I'm always in the market. So, you know, when people say, oh, are you looking? Or, and I would say, yeah, I'm always open. And it's now turned into a passion and hobby and side love of mine, the collecting side. So with some of those people that I mentioned, getting to try bows from those makers that were in their personal collections or reading about them, doing my research, and then eventually playing on them, I started to commission a number of these modern makers or, you know, when they show up at different shops around the world, I will acquire them for my personal collection.
Yeah, I have some questions I want to ask right now, but I do need to ask you a backup question, which again, might seem for us very fundamental, but I think is important to at least be discussed. Why is a bow important? Why can't we just use a carbon fiber bow? I mean, and there are some excellent carbon fiber bows out there, but why are there so many varieties and differences in bows? What is the partnership between the bow to the musician and the bow to the instrument?
Yeah, great question. So the modern bow developed probably mid-1700s to what we currently play on now, the granddaddy of the modern bow, Tort, that name is familiar. So the wood that was chosen, Pernambuco, and there have been a number of different exotic wood species that have been used throughout history, and Pernambuco has been the optimal wood choice for, I mean, its density, its ability to be bent and hold the curve of the stick, for its acoustical properties, you know, its ability to literally take a beating sometimes and to create a sound and not be overly stiff or overly supple. But when it comes to choosing a bow and how important it is, as we mentioned with string instruments, you can take a whole lineup of bows and they can all do very different things or create different sounds. And creating that partnership between the player, the instrument, and the bow, those 3 factors, you know, just at the fundamental level, kind of going off that example, if you take all those variables and someone can sound quite different playing on different instrument and bow combination, or even taking someone and giving them that same instrument and bow combination, situation, they will sound different. So yeah, going back to your analogy of the wand choosing its wizard, I think that's quite similar. The wand, you know, our bow, there's that chemistry, that connection. So that also makes it difficult too when evaluating things for what I decide to purchase and collect. It's, I can make a certain sound or I can do a certain stroke and articulation on my instrument, but if I only collect things that work for me, then that's a very limited set of what, you know, can be done.
Sure. Also, I just feel like I should preface that Pernambuco wood is actually an endangered species. Am I?
It is, correct.
Right. So just so people do understand that it's because of deforesting in the Amazon and South America. So I don't know how much of the bow making industry is contributing to the endangeredness of the tree. I think it's more probable that it's farming and
farming. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's actually, so if I'm correct, from what I understand, the bow making industry is not contributing significantly to its demise. I mean, initially, Pernambuco was used as a dye, I believe, for fabrics centuries ago. When you put Pernambuco shavings into water, it can dye things from a light pink to a very deep, deep purple. So that those properties were why it was harvested. I mean, it's also been used for furniture. But, you know, if you think back to centuries ago when it was in abundance and not an endangered species, these makers, you know, had a plethora of wood to choose from, the best wood.
Right.
And so now that it's endangered, it's much more protected. And I think, if I'm getting the acronym correct, ICPI, International Conservation of Pernambuco, it's a wonderful group of bow makers and experts that have started this conservation efforts to replant Pernambuco in Brazil.
Right. So I just wanted to say that it is an endangered species, but not to feel necessarily guilty for using a violin bow or cello bow or viola bow.
Right. And yeah, and oftentimes when I talk with makers that I'm commissioning orders from, I've learned that a lot of them say, oh, I have enough Pernambuco for the rest of my life.
Wow.
And so it's not like they're actively like harvesting.
Yeah.
A lot of them have wood selected from many, many decades ago. And often, you know, there's a lot of strict import laws on it. So oftentimes they have to be certified as a certain age, and so to limit deforestation.
Okay. Thanks for answering some of those basic questions of like, why are these things important? Why do we spend so much time? Why do we go on road trips? I've gone on my own road trips to find my instrument and bows, you know, things like this. Why do we do this? So going forward, how many bows and instruments are in your inventory?
I just got a shipment yesterday of 3 bows, a trio that I commissioned. It's actually soon to be a quartet. When I initially made the order, I did a trio, and then I kind of changed my mind. I've been moving toward quartets. So it's somewhere over 54 bows now.
Wow.
And sorry to any bassists listening, I don't collect any bass bows. And it's partly because I don't know how to evaluate them in terms of playability.
Sure.
And there's very much that aspect in terms of cello bows. So yeah, cello, I have the fewest amount of, and then the most amount, of course, I have viola, and then violin thereafter. But yeah, it's about 50-something. And I also have 23 Pernambuco blanks. So okay. A very famous bow maker and restorer, Paul Martin Seafried, unfortunately passed away, I believe, November of 2019. He was in Port Townsend, Washington, one of the meccas of American bow making, and his estate. Luckily, I was able to acquire some Pernambuco blanks from his estate before the rest went to auction.
Wow, yeah.
So I decided to purchase those. And, you know, some people have asked if I'm going to make on my own with them. So TBD,
really?
I would love to learn, even if it's just to make, you know, a couple bows here and there. But I mean, this wood is so good that I don't want to ruin it.
Yeah, I know,
so,
right? That's
Oh, I mean, at some point, either I'll learn how to make a bow with it, or have some of the bow makers that I'm ordering from either select wood from it. But by and large, I mean, these makers have got extraordinary wood already.
Right. So the fundamentals of a bow, of course, is going to be the selection of Pernambuco wood. But then there's also, and of course, there's horsehair, but that horsehair gets replaced usually once every 3 months if you're a professional playing very frequently. Or should be, right? And there's also variations of what kind of hair to get. There's white, and you can do salt and pepper, you can just get pepper, or, you know, black hair, whatever. That's a whole other conversation. Rosin also is a whole other conversation too. Mm-hmm. Let's not go into those things today. But what about the frog, which is where, that's where our hand holds the bow, and the tip? Mm-hmm. Those elements also can be made out of different materials. Can you explain a little bit about those properties and how that changes either the playability or the value of
Sure. Let me go ahead and grab one right here. Actually, this is one of the bows that just came in yesterday. Yeah, as you were mentioning, down here at the frog, where we hold the bow.
I don't know why it's called the frog, by the way. Do you know?
That's a good question. I mean, in French, we would say the talon, the heel. But yeah, I don't know why it's translated to frog.
Ribbit, ribbit.
Yeah, so the black piece of wood down here where we hold the bow, the frog, is made of ebony, which is often sourced from Madagascar, Africa. Sometimes I think Vietnam as well. And then we also have ebony down here in what's called the button, or some people say the screw, how we turn
to tighten the hair.
And those are usually either a solid core of ebony, which is capped with metal. So either silver or gold. This bow happens to be gold.
And gold tends to be a higher value point.
Yeah. Yeah, we would say gold mounted or silver mounted.
Sure.
So yeah, anytime we have the mounts on the bow, any of the metal on the bow, we would say the mounts. As I mentioned, like the one, if you can see, it's ebony in the center, and that's the core. And then on both sides, we have it capped with gold. And then also down here, what's called the ferrule, that's also metal. And as I was going to say...
That's where the hair meets the frog, and that's where there's a wedge that tightens and keeps the hair from falling out of the boat. Yeah.
Right. So there's an internal, what's called a mortise inside the frog, which has a plug that secures that hair in there. And then there's that, as I mentioned, that plug, that wedge, which connects the hair and the frog, and then that metal piece, the ferrule, and spreads the hair out and keeps it nice, snug in place and spread out to be a even, consistent ribbon of hair for us to play on. Other materials, we have abalone shell or mother of pearl on there, you know, throughout the course of history. And we have different materials such as tortoise shell, another endangered species, which not allowed to use unless it's certified as pre-convention. Can't remember the dates on that. Some countries are different dates, either 92 or 94. And then there's also ivory, unfortunately, was used as well, no longer allowed. Some makers use mammoth. So yeah, all these materials that are endangered are regulated and controlled, and oftentimes just making sure that they're certified pre-convention is what we would say. Another animal component that we have on here is the leather grip. So it could be anything from sheepskin or like cowhide, or on the specific bow is lizard skin.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Sorry, lizard. Yeah.
Lizard, yeah. So since there are some makers that do complete animal-free bows, and they call them like Voyager bows or stealth bows, so that there's no animal product other than the horse hair. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the horse is not harmed in the harvesting of the hair, I believe.
Although I also have heard that there are some people trying to get vegan hair. So like some kind of plant-based, though of what I understand as well, it's not quite as effective yet as horse hair. But we'll see. I mean, it's just an interesting concept, is to try to just make it plant-based in general.
Yeah, I know that some makers are choosing not to use abalone shell or mother of pearl anymore. There's a manufactured material that can be customized to look certain ways. And so you get certain marble effects or certain designs that you can create. So that's one of the things I know some modern makers are using, this alternative material. I believe it's called dichrolam.
And then at the tip in the past also has primarily been ivory. And now...
Right. So yeah, there are a couple new options. It can either be pre-convention ivory, mammoth, plastic, metal as well. Yeah. So, I mean, I have some silver and gold mounted bows that have also metal at the tip plate. And that just comes down to the maker's preference. Sometimes they need the tip to be lighter if it's already heavy and dense enough and the balance is toward the tip. So yeah, that all changes from bow to bow.
So given all these factors and all these different customizable things, especially when you're working directly with a maker, how does that relationship work?
So this specific bow, for example, I was playing on it earlier today. This is a viola bow. This is a bow by Matt Wheeling.
Matt Wheeling, he's a native.
Twin Cities. Yeah.
Yeah, he's great.
Wonderful guy. Yeah. Yeah. I know a lot of professional musicians play on them, but just absolutely stunning. When I first met him in 2019, was in New York City, but we had been emailing before then because I knew a number of friends that played on his bows. And getting to try a maker's bows is really important, just to be able to say, here's what I liked. Maybe for me, and going back to what we were saying, that relationship between musician, instrument, and bow, you can play someone's bow and like the way it sounds on their instrument, but then you play it on yours and maybe you'd like to tweak some things. So there's a bit of customization that they can do for you. So specifically in this instance, when I met him and tried one of his viola bows that was available in New York, unfortunately didn't acquire it at the time, but I said, you know, I love these characteristics, the sound, the way it handles for spiccato, certain strokes, the way it gets a nice depth out of my instrument, warmth, certain colors. So yeah, bow makers are able to find specific pieces of wood that they think are suitable for the kinds of sound qualities that you're looking for, or things that are maybe will eventually be known as a springy bow, or things that are slightly more supple. They can select woods based on their density, weight, so on and so forth, to adapt to what you're looking for.
And grain direction, that kind of thing too. Yeah, I mean, it can get really specific really quickly. How do you finance your collection?
Yeah, I mean, it's with my close friends, you know, like I joke with them that I'm playing a certain gig or something because I have the bow payments.
Uh-huh.
Or, you know, you got to save up for that next order. So it is a lot of my personal finances going toward it. So I might, you know, cut back in other areas and say, well, maybe this month I'm not going to spend as much on eating out or, you know.
Okay, so you definitely budget for this
stuff. Yes. And especially because with so many bows coming in, I have to tell myself, like, just make sure that things are spaced out with adequate time to make sure that I'm not, like, overstretching myself. Also resisting the temptation when things come up at auction.
Oh, gosh.
Or, you know, I happen to see, I'm always checking inventory across the world, actually. And so I'll see, oh, something came up and maybe I want this, or maybe now's not the time because this trio is coming in next month and I should really focus on that.
So you are very specific about what you're looking for or who you're commissioning from. Are there any particular makers that, for any listeners who are either looking for a bow or interested, or even just makers too, like viola or violin makers, are there any particular ones that you've had a positive relationship with or highly recommend their products?
Yeah, that's a great question.
I mean, you already mentioned Matt Wheeling, who I would also second. He has great bows. I don't own one of his, but I've played many of his and they're really great.
I mean, the list is so long and I feel bad like leaving anyone off. I will say that, I mean, there are a lot of wonderful American bow makers. I mentioned Port Townsend, Washington is kind of the mecca in the US, but also Minnesota has a lot of great makers between Matt Wheeling and Roger Zabinski. You play in a Zabinski, right?
I do, yeah. My bow is even more connected to Minnesota because it was previously part of the bow collection of Bob Jameson, who was, before Tony Ross, was the principal cellist of the Minnesota Orchestra. And when he passed in 2018, I happened upon that bow and I just fell in love with it. It's a beautiful bow. And Roger is a wonderful person too. I learned a lot from him just talking to him about bow making. We spent like 2 hours just chatting. But anyway, continue your list.
Yeah, I mean, you asked, like, I mean, they've all been positive experiences. I think craftsmen, these instrument bow makers are all such wonderful people. And it really is a treat and a pleasure getting to speak with them about instruments and getting to understand their world. I mean, if you're looking for like historical or like Baroque bows, I know that Andrew Dipper is another great person in the Twin Cities area.
Yep, connected to the Claire Givens violin shop here.
Exactly. Someone that I overlapped with in Cleveland, I believe he's now back in Minnesota, Jesse Berndt.
Oh, yeah.
I know he
rehairs my bows.
Yeah. So I know he's also a wonderful rehairer, but also I think is focusing a lot on bow making now. And kind of going back to Washington, I mean, the list is quite long there. I mentioned Paul Martin Seyfried, who's deceased, but there's Charles Espy, and then his pupils, Cody Kowalski, who now lives in Germany, Robert Morrow, Ulle Kainstrom. And then I think further west in Washington, there's Morgan Anderson and his wife. And then I mentioned the Minnesota makers. And then you get into like Boston, Benoit Roland is a highly sought after maker. There's Joe DeCun in Miami, you know, Isaac Salko in New York. Going back to Boston, sorry, then I'm all over the place. You know, David Hawthorne is there and lots of great makers all around. I mean, in whatever city you're living in, like, there's so many, like, it's hard to list them all. You know, this all goes back to the French tradition of bow making. And so, you know, France, I mean, the list is just quite long. But you can follow the lineage of bow making from Mirecourt in France to Paris, and then that school of modern bow making, the last big teacher of the French school, Bernard Houchard, and the pupils that he had and where that stems from. So Bernard Houchard, then you'll get like Stéphane Thomachot, who also worked on it with Espy at some point, and Thomachot taught Noel Burke taught Gary Leahy. Those are Irish makers. And then from there, it's just the list just keeps going and going and going, and really, really wonderful makers from the Nair family in France. I know I'm missing some of the bass bow makers, Jean Grimberger. Yeah, it's a really, really long list. I know I'm missing a lot of people.
I know. And that's where, for anyone who's entering and considering upgrading their instrument, because normally when you start, you go to your local, you know, store and you rent your instrument or you get a student instrument. But this is where you start really becoming more serious with your playing, and you really want to see what more possibilities and what colors, what strokes, etc., that you can discover within yourself and within what the instrument can allow you to do and or bow. This can get really, really overwhelming for a lot of people. It was really overwhelming for me when I was going through this, and I've gone through a couple instrument shopping and bow shopping experiences, and the lineage is just so huge, like the mm-hmm. tree and roots of all these bow makers and all these instrument makers is, yeah, it's just overwhelming, and it's easy to be led down the wrong path.
So yeah, I know what you mean. So yeah, I mean, with anything, it's a bit of an information game, right? right?
Right. And so, that's where I'm so grateful that you're willing to share your research of our modern day makers with our audiences, because, I mean, they are producing some of the best bows at a price point that is very reasonable and manageable for many families. I mean, most of these bows are under 10 grand, which sounds ridiculous to most people. But when you consider getting a tort bow, like one of the fanciest, those can get up to 25 grand or 30 grand easily just for a stick for some people.
If we're talking about like Francois Xavier tort, if it's a mint condition or like what you would call a fine state of preservation, easily over $350,000 to $500,000.
Right. I mean, like museum pieces. But yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. So, I mean, yes, it is a lot of money, but the modern makers are not only just producing excellent pieces of work, but they're also very affordable. Mm-hmm. And something, as you mentioned earlier, being the first people to activate these pieces of wood, it's almost kind of an exciting discovery of not just of what we are discovering for ourselves with these tools, but that they're also growing with us and with how it's this relationship.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that I'm forgetting to ask you, or are there any last points that you want to mention?
Yeah, I can, if there's time, to briefly describe like how to select a bow.
Sure.
I personally have kind of narrowed things down to how I will evaluate bows. For example, like when I go into a shop or I have a selection to choose from, I usually have stock, solo, and orchestra excerpts, things that require us to do different articulation strokes, get different sounds. I have those stock excerpts that I'll play through. And I mean, there are a number of bow makers say like the three top priorities are sound, sound, and sound.
Yeah.
And I will push back on that a little bit, because I've gone the path of sound, 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 and then struggle to get a good spiccato. And then I'm focusing a lot, the bouncing of the bow. So I think it has to be, you have to find the balance. Is there going to be the most versatile, can do everything bow? In some cases, yes, I found that. And in many cases, you know, this is why I collect, is because, like I said, you will have like 18 viola bows and they all do different things better than the other. I mean, they're all beautiful works of art that are musical tools. So yeah, just knowing, having that, your stock excerpts to play through and know like, okay, how versatile is it? What can it do? And especially things on different strings. So if you're looking for sound, different registers and all that. And also, you know, play when you're trying stuff, play in chamber ensembles, play in different settings. You might think, okay, this sounds great in a hall, and then you get into a drier, smaller space, and then it's different. So you have to try them in different settings as well. But yeah, I think that helps me efficiently evaluate when I know like, okay, I got a set amount of time, going to knock it out and then evaluate.
Yeah, that's really great advice. As you're talking about, you know, this sort of what is the three priorities, it slightly reminded me of, since we talked about Switch earlier and Mario Kart, you know, when you're customizing your car and you're picking the wheels for best traction, or you're picking the car for the weight, or the parachute for the best flying, or whatever, or even the character, it kind of was reminding me similar to bow searching or instrument searching, where there's never going to be one character that is all of those things. You're going to compromise on some, maybe it's going to be projection or power, or it's going to be the stroke, or it's going to be maybe a color that maybe one bow has better than the other or something like that. But overall, the goal is to find the composite best that works for you and what your needs are as a musician. So anyway, just to put Mario Kart in the... in the analogy here. Okay, well, thank you so much. And I know like this can be a conversation that would last forever. Maybe I would love to have you back, maybe in a panel discussion about, in general, more in depth of searching for an instrument, searching for bows, the specifics of things like this, if you're willing.
Yeah, yeah. We'll talk.
Okay, can I ask you two final questions?
Sure.
What is one piece of advice you would tell your younger self about entering and pursuing a music career?
Yeah, this piece of advice comes from some close friends, and it's about believing in myself. A dear friend once said to me, "Siggy, the worst part about your playing is that you don't realize how good you are."
Ooh.
And I always remember that, because anytime I have doubt or feel less than or insecure, or just, you know, that imposter syndrome, is just reminding myself I'm here for a reason. I have something to say, and trust that like everything that I've worked toward is valued, and like, don't question that, you know? I mean, you say it on all your episodes, like the loving yourself from Mama RuPaul.
Yes.
You know, all these things that, like, you know, I also tell my students that, like, I wish that I had heard when I was 13, 14, 15, and struggling with how you emerge from these layers and layers of insecurities, knowing your worth and that you have something to say and, like, speak up for what it is that you believe in and whatever area of your life.
Right. That's great advice, and one that can transcend not just this conversation, but just how we all can utilize that in our day-to-day life. And I can also affirm, as another friend, that I think your best playing is when you do believe in yourself most, Siggy.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I agree. We're all dealing with the last year and a half plus in our own ways. And so like that, it's reemerged for me, like finding a sense of purpose or like motivation and discipline to practice and then feel good about getting back on the concert stage.
Yes.
And so, you know, I've had to deal with that where like maybe I didn't feel the best or like know how to get back into performing emerging from the pandemic and still, you know, part of that process that's going to be very different for everyone. But yeah, reminding myself that like you're good enough and like, get it.
Yeah, get it. And it's process. Like we're always evolving and changing and what we think our best is always going to change. So it's a double-edged sword in some ways like that.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. And my second question, as we enter a changing pandemic world, what elements of your musical pandemic life would you want to continue and what would you want to shed?
Well, something that I tell people is that the bow collecting has kept me sane throughout the pandemic. I mean, it's given me something to really look forward to and doing a lot of research. I'm looking up at my bookshelf here on my left and the instrument and bow book collection alone has just grown considerably. And so just studying pictures and playing the what is this game with some friends where we just look at, we send each other pictures of things and I just try and guess. But yeah, I'd like to continue that. And obviously I will. Mm-hmm. Something I'd like to shed. I tried gardening. I don't have a green thumb, so I'm shedding that. I think I have one basil plant still alive.
Okay.
But in terms of like either habits or things.
Maybe self-doubt, I say with a smile.
Yeah. And then, you know, that like, as we mentioned, that's going to be a process.
Of course. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just trying to be a friend encouraging. But yeah, I mean, that doesn't have to be your answer.
Yeah. I don't know. Shedding. Oh, yeah, get back to you on that.
Okay. All right. Are there any platforms or websites for our listeners to learn more about you or any upcoming projects or collections?
My website needs to be revamped, but projects coming up.
But what is your website?
Oh, sergeyandyap.com. And then Instagram, siggy516, S-I-G-G-Y-516. I don't post enough bows. I mean, part of that goes with, you know, as I mentioned, the imposter syndrome and also like doubting my photography skills. So yeah, but that's something that like people have asked me like, oh, you should post more bows in your collection. But I think there's so many like great, like I mentioned, some of those other people that actually have fantastic Instagram pages. And that's kind of what inspired me is seeing their photography work of these bows, both antique and modern. I'm just like, you know, drooling. Mm-hmm. So yeah, check out those people. Yeah, projects. I mean, all with all those ensembles that I mentioned. Yeah, concerts coming up.
Kinetic, Loop 38, and Musica. You were also mentioning that you're playing with Houston Grand Opera currently as well.
Yeah, playing most of the season. So very excited for that. We just finished Carmen. Wonderful run of Carmen. So yeah, lots of bouncing around Houston.
Yeah, great. And if you enjoyed listening, be sure to smash that subscribe button wherever you're tuning into this podcast. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts while you're at it. It doesn't need to be long. Your review will help others search for the podcast because of its crazy algorithms, and you'll make Sushi's day. And it's free. Make sure to share this podcast with your friends and family as well. If you want to level up, you can always become part of the Haydn Behind the Music Stand family by donating what you will on our Patreon page at patreon.com/HaydnMusicStand. Our social media handle for Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter is at Haydn Music Stand, and we'd love to hear from you at our email, haydnmusicstand@gmail.com. Didn't recognize a piece we discussed during the episode? No worries. There's a Spotify playlist with all the music discussed for your convenience. The link is in the description of each episode. Siggy, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and your life story with us today. Again, it's so good to see you. I can't wait for the next time to come down and give you a huge hug, and hopefully, if you're willing, let me try some of your cello bows.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I know it's been in the works. It's so great to see you and see Sushi and get to chat and catch up. Due for a much longer conversation and hopefully next time in person.
Absolutely.
I've been meaning to make it up to Minnesota as well. So
yes.
I'd love to see you.
You should. There's so many bows up here. Come up.
Yeah.
All right. And thanks for listening. Sushi, say bye.